First things first, guys, welcome. Is this thing on? Okay, good. Couple of things. I have a pretty thick Puerto Rican accent, so if you don't understand something, feel free to go ahead and ask me again. I'll be sure to have my wife translate for me. Another thing, this is going to be pretty much the perspective of one man fighting the war on terror. I'm on side by side amongst the best this nation has to offer. You're going to hear some true stories and some stories that are pretty much heard, but you didn't know who performed in those particular missions, specifically that Ehrman had a role in that. This is pretty much the layout of what we're going to be doing tonight. Jack of all trades. We're going to talk about the origins, basically how I came across this this particular opportunity to do this this great job, the training that it took to become one. Quick job description for those of you who do not know what Pararescue does. Current missions and lessons learned there, and this is based on my own experiences and some of my friends. Sacrifices, pretty much encapsulating everything that we go through. And then lastly, final perspectives, kind of like Jerry Springer's final thoughts. So one thing I will say right now that this presentation contains some graphic images and some truthful accounts of battles. So I'm going to try to go ahead and keep it as real as possible. I will not water anything down. You guys got to come to terms with the reality of war, what we're going through right now. Before we move on any further, I have about a four and a half minute video clip that goes through Pararescue. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get started with that.
I'm a staff sergeant in the Air Force, and I've been a pararescue for 3 years. Actually, when I came into the Air Force, I was about 6 months out of high school. I guess I had a part-time job, stocked groceries late at night, and I just knew there was something more out there. And, I wanted to be in the Air Force, but I wanted something that you get as a SEAL, something that you get as a Marine Force Recon, something that you get is on the Green Beret. And I didn't realize the Air Force had anything like this. To me, it just seems like the greatest job in the world. You know, where else can you be in the military, serve your country, be able to skydive, be able to dive, you learn how to rock climb, do high angle rescues, all the things that any type A personality guy would just love to do and get paid for it. So I've just been doing this for a long time. Overseas up north, basically providing what we call airborne combat search and rescue. It's a pilot was to get shot down, unfortunately, or if a special forces team member was to go down, then our job would be to cross into enemy territory, go and find him, battle out of there, stabilize him, and bring it back to good guy land. Thousands of SEALs, there's thousands of Green Berets, and there's thousands of Marine Corps recon. There's probably 300 PJs in the Air Force, and I like that.
Still hiring for all of you guys in the crowd if you want a job. All right, let's talk about origins. How does one become a special operator in the United States military, which is probably one of the toughest duties out there? For me, growing up, I was a free spirit. You know, everything, I wanted it now, and I wanted it 2 years before I was supposed to be doing it. By 2 years, I wanted roller skates because my sisters were roller skating. By age 4 or 5, I thought I was Steve Austin, and I was leaping from houses and gladly didn't break any bones. Mom, thanks a lot for not medicating me during those times, especially when I was going to the supermarket with her wearing underoos with a towel wrapped around my neck thinking that I was Superman. But it takes a special kind of animal to do this kind of job. And the more and more I get to know about my friends, the more I know that we're so close yet so far apart when it comes to mentality. Always a dreamer, always wanted something more. And that is basically what pushed me to do this. And this is pretty much what it takes to become one. It's about 2 years of training. And the beginning stepping stone is the pararescue and combat rescue officer indoctrination course at Lackland. They call it indoctrination because it's a kindler, gentle Air Force. What it is a selection and a kick in the butt to see which man will stand standing. In our class, we had 112 candidates that began training. We had a Christmas break. After that week, about 55, 60 came back. That's 50% gone. By the end of the 12 weeks, we had only 12 that graduated the first 12 weeks. Now, throughout the course of the rest of the pipeline, by the time we got done to the end, there were only 9 that ended up becoming pararescuemen. So that gives you a perspective of pretty much what our washout rates are. So after we get done with the indoctrination course and we pick the guys that are going to continue, we used to go to the combat diver course, the special forces course in Key West, Florida. Here about 3 years ago, we broke ground on our own program, which is phenomenal, which is tailored more for what we do, which is recovery operations underwater. And that is now in Panama City, Florida. From there, we go ahead and permanent change of station all of our students to Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico. And we start farming them out to all the different schools, which include EMT B and P, which is basically an 18-month course that we're crunched down to 6 months. And our guys are some of the best paramedics out there. Army Basic Airborne, basically any dummy can go to that school. You just get on a plane, you strap something on your back, you jump out, you land, and then you do it again. 6 times or 5 times, and then you're good to go, golden. Then we go to military free fall, which is a little bit more technical. There, they bring you to a plane. You go ahead and go up. You jump, but you have to open your own parachute this time. And it is a lot more technical because it's precision parachuting, how to basically just navigate 4 miles to be able to get from point A to point B. You also go to survival training. Mostly every single IRCA member in the Air Force goes through this particular training. But we go through some other steps after that one on how to survive and how to survive in captivity. And lastly, the Pararescue and Combat Rescue Officer Apprentice Course at Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico. That is 6 months to where you put all of these vehicles together. This is to get from point A to point B, but what do you do when you get there? That's where you actually tie it all together. And you tie it all together to perform this mission. 25 graduates in 2001. We have 115 grads last year, and that is basically after September 11, we had a spike. Our young men ended up signing up because they wanted to do their duty. And Jeff spoke about the anger after 9/11, and a lot of us felt that. I was serving at the time. I was in Virginia Beach when the plane struck the the Twin Towers, and I have just gotten back from a run. And we'll go through that process to let you know exactly how things panned out after a particular day and incident. And this is the mission of a pararescueman. In a nutshell, you guys can read the slide, but it's rescue anytime, anywhere. And why do we need rescue? Because bad things happen. We're asking people to put themselves in harm's way, from the soldier to the airman to the sailor, in every single environment. We have trees, we have mountains, we have sand, we have water, we have snow. And we have to be proficient in every single environment, because when things go wrong, we are the 911 call that goes in response to these things. And why so fit? Why do we have to be physically fit? Even as a chief, right now I have to keep up with my 19 and 21-year-olds, which most of them can't keep up with me anyways, but that's the nature of the beast. But reason being is because when you put yourself in harm's way to get somebody out of trouble, what are the chances that they're able to walk out with you? Pretty slim to none. Chances are you're going to have to carry somebody. Not only that, but you have to carry all this equipment. And what I have here is just personal equipment. This is personal sustainment. It doesn't include any of the rescue equipment that we have to put on in addition to that. And you saw the last man on the video with all the parachuting equipment with the oxygen mask. That's about 130 pounds of equipment altogether, including the parachute and everything. So a guy like me that weighs about 150, that's doubling my weight. Now, you get some of these other beefcakes that we have in the periphery that are 6'4", 240 pounds. It's like carrying a fanny pack. But to make it look cool, we'll say that the equipment is on me. And what you have here is just an assortment of weapons. Right now we have a carbine sidearm for a close quarter battle, medical equipment to include narcotics, and a small surgical kit to be able to do surgical procedures downrange, 40 mic 556, Belgian grenades, load-bearing equipment with survival, helmets, and so on, so on. So you see, pretty much you saw the first picture in the origin slide, where I have Don Quixote, and then on the overview I have the Jack of all trades. And that is because we have to be able to react to every single environment. And every single society has had such special warriors, pretty much the men that people call upon when nobody else wants to do the deed. They also know that hard times call for hard men. And one specific group here is the Spartans. And the reason I use them is because there was 300 of them that held the gates at Thermopylae against millions of Muslims that were trying to overtake their land. And there's only about 300 pararescuemen nowadays. And notice the crimson, pretty much, our maroon beret and their capes pretty much go side by side. And plus, I think that if we got into a bar fight with these guys now, we'll win, because they're wearing dresses. And we just keep doing that. But, you know, pretty much like them, society has always needed somebody to call upon when things go horribly wrong. Not only that, but somebody that is willing to sacrifice his own life for somebody else to have a better life. And that is what pararescue is all about. 911 for everyone. It says at the bottom, because even SEALs, Green Berets, and Recon Marines need to call 911. And that is true, because we put ourselves in harm's way. We go where nobody else wants to go. And when the best of the best get in trouble, who are they going to call upon? Not Ghostbusters. They call us. The following slides that I'm going to show you have a couple of graphic pictures. That, but like I said in the beginning of the lecture, is basically to make sense and justice of what we're trying to put across here. We have a lot of guys sacrificing so much, and right now there's guys in the fight out there getting ready to go ahead and get after it, after the enemy. And we do a lot of missions. Most of the public ties us to a helicopter doing search and rescue up and down the hoist. And that was true in Southeast Asia. Nowadays, we have developed and morphed into all these other capabilities, because as war evolves, demand has to evolve as well. And I like to call us the big great white shark. It's almost unchanged, but it always adapts to its environments to make sure that it remains up on top. First one we're going to talk about is combat search and rescue. The same thing that we were doing in Southeast Asia, which pararescue is mostly famous for. Combat search and rescue ended up flying about 100 sorties in OEF and some in OIF. It was basically covering about a 1,400-man task force, about 700 ground and air assets that were in and out performing missions every night. sometimes two, maybe three missions going on simultaneously. And we were on what they call a 30-minute string. Basically, something happens, you have the blades turning, and you go ahead and react to it. A lot of great missions happen out there in Afghanistan, and I was lucky to do this particular job for just one rotation. Most of my rotations were pretty much direct action attached to a SEAL team. But this is one of the most noble things we do. And if you look at the tally record, pretty much when you look at what CNN, what Fox News, and everything is putting out, people performing into rescue, you can almost guarantee that pararescue is involved in most of them, including this one here that most of you pretty much heard about, the rescue of Jessica Lynch. The picture doesn't lie. That's pararescue man Chris Telsworth, and that flag right there is the flag that she was clenching in her fist when she was brought out of Iraq into Landstuhl, Germany. The press put out that it was the Marines that recovering. Yeah, well, that is true. There was a smaller group of men that were doing the technical aspects of the mission. And this pararescue man here made sure that he got her at ease, packaged her, and made sure he got her to safety. Up to this day, they're friends. And Chris is a great pararescue man. He's actively serving right now in Davis Mountain, Arizona. But he was the one that when she said, "Hey, I'm an American," he told, "Hey, I'm an American too. Just go ahead and hold on to this. This is who we are." Because she was hysterical, and if you go on YouTube, you can pretty much watch an entire hit. But it was a pretty good mission that led us to her based on a good Samaritan, a good Iraqi lawyer. I never thought I'd say those words, good lawyer. But a good Iraqi lawyer came out and said, "Hey, I have seen this girl. I think it's somebody that you're looking for. She's an American. You guys need to do something about it." Because most of the other people that had gotten captured with her had either been assassinated, killed, and buried in a soccer field close by the hospital, which was the ranger's job to go and dig in the bodies, which is no easy task because they had been decomposed for quite a while. But we got Jessica back, and that was a huge win for the United States and for West Virginia, I guess. Nothing happens in there. Let's talk about direct action for a little bit. This is pretty much when you put special tactics personnel, combat weather, pararescue men, combat control, and TACPs attached with other services. So it's basically what we call a rainbow coalition. A lot of services pretty much interacting together. And most of these missions were looking for targets, specific targets. Our targets were the top three. If you look at a base hierarchy, you have the wing, group, and squadron. We were taking care of the wing and group commanders. Everything below that was for the conventional forces. And this is probably one of the most rewarding missions that we ended up doing out there because it was immediate feedback. When you capture somebody, you got some good intelligence out of them. When you kill somebody, you know that there was one less bad guy on the street. And as you can see, part of it is also taking most of their assets away from them. Pretty primitive in nature, but they're pretty advanced when it comes to their thought process in combat because they've been doing it for a long time, a lot longer than I have been on this earth. And, yes, I'm 38, just in case. Don't let the knowledge frost fool you. But I want to talk about one mission here specifically that was that is part of the War Airmen exhibit, and this is a mission going after a gentleman called Mahmoud Shah. This one particular guy was transporting potassium cyanide back and forth from Pakistan, and we have been tracking him for about 30 days. And we got the call, the trigger to go ahead and go and get them. Immediately upon infiltration into the site, we were landing the 47s into a dry riverbed. When the helicopter, my helicopter was the first one coming in, when it came in full final, we started hearing all these pings going around, and we thought it was pretty much the small rocks from the dry riverbed. Then the flight engineer gets rocked back, and the right gunner starts screaming, "Get out, get out." He says some other word, but we won't say that word here. It starts with an F and ends with a K. He ended up just going ahead, "Get out." And as we start running out, we start seeing muscle flashes coming from three different directions. And we talk about trying to get small behind riverbed rocks. They're not many big ones. And we had this indigenous force with us, and those guys just pretty much scatter around the place. And then there were myself and these two gentlemen right here just pretty much looking to where the enemy were going, and they were still actively engaging us. The problem here was that we didn't know who else was around that dry riverbed. They were waiting for us, and there were three other helicopters coming in. So immediately, my buddy right here in the middle, Coop, made the call to go ahead and start chasing these guys, and they were chasing up, chasing them up the hill, which is pretty much not an advantageous point because they can easily just dig in and shoot down, and then we're toast. But we ended up overrunning them, and then the indigenous forces caught up and started running after us too, so it looked like a lot more dudes were coming after the bad guys. But we ended up eliminating the threat. I personally shot two with my weapon. Coop and Mark ended up killing a couple more, and basically we stopped the attack. What we ended up finding out is that they had a cache of RPGs, PKM, and a lot of other weapons that they could have potentially gone up that hill and waited for the other helicopters to come in and down one of them. So that changed the tide of that particular battle. Once we got done with it, they had a whole bunch of materials that they were using for suicide bombs and everything else. And we got some good intel because we ended up capturing Mahmoud Shah's brother. Mahmoud Shah was one of the guys that we ended up shooting from the get-go. And he was a pretty bad guy. But we ended up getting some good information on some follow-on targets that we had. And one of those was this particular mission that we ended up doing jointly with the SAS. And on this one, we got word that there was a guy that was selling drugs to go ahead and fund terrorism. And this guy was not only selling drugs, but we got intelligence that he was providing documents for people to do cross-border operations, do bad things, and then go back out pretty much scot-free. So he was providing a sanctuary for bad guys. When we walked upon this target, the guy had just huge amounts of hashish. And he ended up selling them and then funding terror. And some of the weapons that we saw earlier were some of his. As a show of force, we normally went ahead and put explosive in the cache to destroy the weapons, and then we destroy some of the products, some of the other stuff we confiscated. We had been up probably for about 36 hours at this point, and we were taking speed, we were taking amphetamines, what they call go pills, just to be able to press on with the mission at the time. And we started burning this hashish, and I got the bright idea, and I was like, hey, Coop, go ahead and take a picture. This is kind of cool, man. It's a bunch of drugs, and I got these guys, indigenous guys. Yeah, that's something to put in the album. The camera died, so Coop went back to get another battery. So in the meantime, we're standing next to the scene. If you can see the way the smoke is just actually flowing. So we ended up standing there. Coop comes back with the second camera. He snaps the pictures and everything else. And by then, man, it's just like, all right, well, what else do we need to do? Where are we going? It was a five-hour ride back to the base, and I swear to God, guys, that I understood this man. They were speaking Pashto, and I was just like, yeah, right on, man. I get you. I ate about five MREs on the travel back, and they had to sign a statement that I was exposed to this stuff. So lesson learned here, don't stand too close to a pile of burning hashish, especially raw product. Then surveillance and reconnaissance. Another lesson learned was that the enemy was pretty smart about conventional tactics. We started out doing the direct action missions, infiltrating by helicopter. One problem, most of the valleys out there are in bowls, and you have to go through mountain passes to get to them. When the helicopters were about 7 miles from target, the sound just traveled so fast through those canyons that they heard the helicopters coming. By the time we got to the villages, it was what we call a dry hole. There was nobody there. So we started using this nifty thing called UAVs. We're like, all right, so we've been hitting dry hole after dry hole. Let's see what's going on here. We ended up employing the UAVs, and we send up dummy runs of helicopters, resupplies, and we'll film what happened, what's going on. So no kidding, you know, about 7 minutes out, people dispersing like roaches out of the villages. We're like, okay. So they're hearing us right around this time, blah, blah, blah. So we had the intel guys with the 20-pound brains out there. Well, based on my calculations, because of the wind, whatever, dude, how long does it take for them to hear this helicopter? They're like, you got to be about 7 miles. I was like, all right, cool. So we started thinking outside the box, and you're going to see a lot of pictures with beards and everything else. We had to outsmart him, just like General Olds used to do back in the days, putting like communist stars in his aircraft and everything else just to gain a little bit of advantage because the enemy was getting too good. Now, we're fighting them in their own backyard. So by looking like them will give us some means of infiltrating, especially a little guy like me, skinny, brown, with a big beard, you know. I fit in perfect. So we used to go ahead and get on a taxi cab with another interpreter and drive through the village. When the helicopters were coming around, okay, they're running that direction, that direction, that direction. It's like, all right, check, take notes. When the real hit will come, we'll have forces in place all around the village. Now, we send the helicopters in. Guys start running out. It was like a bad episode of Cops. People getting tackled, people getting captured, and we ended up getting a lot of good guys. Well, good, bad guys, high-value targets that way. The key thing is that we didn't have to kill them. We were catching them alive, which was leading us to some other men that we were looking for. And that was one of the successes there of the mission. And this is, once again, my happy face in Afghanistan after being up for like 36 hours. So, and how many of you guys have seen the War Airman display here at the museum? That is that Cheshire Cat that is in that display right there. And if you look at the belly of that Cheshire Cat, it was dipped in blood a couple of times for numerous reasons. And I'll go ahead and touch upon that in the end when we talked about it. And you're also going to notice that a lot of the men had New York Fire Department and Police Department patches on their uniforms. That was our tribute to them based on the 9/11 events. And when we first went into the war, everyone was angry, guys. Everybody had anger, just like you had anger when you were sitting back here. How dare they? How dare they hit us in our own turf? Well, we got the opportunity to go forward to their turf and go ahead and deal some ass whoopings because they deserve them. And we did it pretty good at first. And we come to realize a lot of things, too, that there is good and bad in everywhere you go. And we got to see it firsthand in some of the villagers, the good, the bad, and the ugly, which was mostly us. This particular mission here, we got infiltrated, and I got to check my records, but I'm almost sure that 357 was one of the helicopters that brought us into that mission. And that is the big 53 that is over there by the War Airman display. But what we ended up doing is we ended up loading some ATVs, and our mission was to travel 120 miles in 3 days through the middle of the desert, no man's land, and resurvey 3 desert landing zones for C-17s to be able to put men in the dirt and get these forward staging bases going. On this particular mission, we ended up, we got infill, and this is shortly right after infill. We got our equipment together and everything else, dust-proofed the weapons, and pretty much made sure that everybody was good to go. And it was self-sustained. We have food, water, and ideas on how to do this. Halfway through the trek, we ended up running upon this. That is a camel. That is an animal that is designed to survive in the desert. And that poor SOB just gave up. So all of us are here just wondering, it's like, man, that camel gave up. What the hell are we doing standing next to him? You know? Not only that, but just when you thought you were in the middle of nowhere, this guy will show up in a bicycle with an AK. It's like the Afghan version of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know? So, of course, we're like, we don't know if this guy's a bad guy, if he's collecting intel. So we were taking pictures of him. And this particular guy right here, he didn't look. I mean, would you trust his savory character? I wouldn't, you know? And that's why you see my gun pointed at his foot. I'm like, if he pulls that AK out, I'm shooting him. And so we ended up just taking it back, make sure that he didn't check out with any of the other pictures. And this particular picture here, this was 3/4 into the mission. We ended up rolling up in the very first airfield that was assaulted in Afghanistan, and that was Objective Rhino. That's the one that most of you saw on CNN, the NVG video of guys parachuting into Afghanistan. We went back, and there's a pretty big camp, a lot of structures, and there was a runway right in that, in there. And it was supposed to be isolated. We got intel the day before saying that there's nobody there, no Afghan military, blah, blah, blah. So we're like, all right, cool. So we're traveling. It's probably right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Daytime, you know, normally like to approach buildings in the nighttime because we had the advantage with the MVGs and everything else. But we ended up deciding, well, it's supposed to be isolated. Let's go ahead and check it out. So as we approach, we gain a little bit of high ground, and we saw some movement within the compound. We're like, okay, well, that's not really good. This is supposed to be isolated. And we're looking for markings, you know, uniforms, things of that nature, making sure that we won't run into insurgents. Well, we decided to send 2 scouts out to get a little bit closer look and get eyes on what was going on. No sooner than those guys ended up going ahead and hitting some soft dirt and kicked up some dust, there were about four Hilux trucks, which is equivalent to a Tacoma, Toyota, with guns mounted on it, packed to the gills. These guys had pretty much mortar rounds, RPGs, and they were coming after us. And they had us flanked. We're like, all right, so what do we do now? There's 10 of us, and there's probably about 40 of them. Combat controller Duke Danforth starts calling for close air support. Can't get anything on the net. We're like, wow, we're going to have to fight this out. So we made the decision to go ahead and try to get into higher ground and get a good fighting position. We see that the trucks are getting closer on the sides, and we're flanked now. So Hans, the team leader, ended up saying, all right, dig in right now. We're going to fight it out. So everybody's just pretty much laying in the middle of the desert, nothing. Just pretty much, if I'm laying face down here with my gun pointing that way, the enemy's pretty much all around. So we're like, all right, this is it. You know, this is going to be our Thermopylae. We're going to fight to the end. But it just so happens that one of the flags in the ATVs pops up, and it's our American flag. The guys kind of look over, and then they just kind of get in one of the trucks and start waving the Afghani flag. We're like, okay, so what's going on here? We sent two scouts to go ahead and meet them. We had snipers trained on the guys that were walking towards us, and we sent the guys, and then we get the radio call back, hey, these guys were for President Karzai. They're good. They want us to have us over for lunch. So we took them up on the offer. We ended up having lunch with them, and as soon as they found out that I had a medical bag with me, there were about 30 of them lined up with all kinds of nasty toes and things like that. So winning hearts and minds, we'll go ahead and treat them and everything else. And, you know, we gave them medical treatment. You know, they gave us food. They also gave us the runs because it was pretty much what we like to call chainsaw chicken. It looks like they just go ahead and put a bag of chickens and just chainsaw and make stew out of them. And But we were grateful that we didn't get into a firefight with them because that would have been really bad, not definitely strategic going for the war. And then low visibility operations. We talked about the taxicab. We talked about some of the things that we needed to do. And once again, it's all about outsmarting the enemy. It was all about, all right, how can we get ahead of them? Because if you got those guys in the mountains, man, they got a loaf of bread, a bladder of water, flip-flops, and man jammies, and they just outrun you and run for days. They got the vantage point. They have been doing this for decades. So we ended up just going ahead and altering our plan over and over again, and low visibility was definitely the way to go. The one lesson learned for me here is like to speak up in English as best as I could so I didn't get shot in the face with the rest of the other guys that were pretty much hiding in the village. Because there was always a big American flag or something hanging from my neck because my friends will tell me, like, dude, you better freaking say something in the dark because I'm going to shoot you. So, but it was a good lesson learned. And then, you know, just treating the guys that were pretty much giving us the intelligence and everything else. But it's unlike any clinic. If you show up to a clinic and your doctor's got a Glock on the side of his head, beware because you may get some treatment that you don't want. But I get always asked, what in the hell are you doing to this guy, Ray? He had back problems, people, all right? There's nothing else going on there. And my hand is gloved for a reason. And then we got some high-profile missions. We were the first team to end up covering on President Hamid Karzai's security detail. This is shortly, we took him out of the country in the beginning, then we put him back in power, and he asked for a team of special operators based on the threat that was coming upon him. And we ended up moving to this little place right across from his palace called the Yellow House. It was basically a gutted place. And we ended up moving some cots, some MREs, some water, and set up pretty much a command post in there to be able to cover his security detail. So basically from the time he woke up to the time he went to bed, we were there with him, escorting him from the palace to the mosque, whatever he traveled. And that was another good lesson learned there about the way we were conducting business, because we ended up hiring people to go ahead and do the cooking for us because it was going to be intensive. We had about 56 guys out in that particular detail. But a lot of our guys were getting sick. And the SEAL commander comes up to me and is like, Ray, I want you to look into this because a lot of our guys are getting really sick. And they're going down for 3 to 5 days at a pot. We're talking about coming out from both ends, just really sick. They couldn't move. The first place that we decided to look was the kitchen. And they had a meat grinder there. So they didn't chainsaw the chickens. They just put them in the grinder and just made them that way. But what we saw is that a lot of the pots and everything else had maggots and other stuff. The meat grinder itself hadn't been cleaned in about a year. So they were feeding us a whole bunch of bad food. So we fired that caterer and ended up getting somebody else and started eating more MREs. But also on this mission, it was early summer in 03 when the 02, I'm sorry. He went to one of his brother's weddings up in the vicinity of Kandahar. And as we're leaving the wedding, he's a pretty proud man. He likes to walk everywhere, which makes it harder for us because he's a huge target. There's a lot of people that want him dead. And in this particular wedding, he comes out and he pretty much gets out of the car and he starts hugging people and everything else. This little seal right here, Fab, that's me right there. Fab is sitting in the rear left. I'm sitting in the rear right. Karzai is sitting in front with the SEAL commander. As soon as Karzai gets out of the car, Fab sees these guys moving really fast, and they're hiding something, so Fab gets out of the car. He comes around the Suburban and sees the guys coming at him, and immediately drops two guys. Shots were fired so fast, they got off a couple of rounds, and the SEAL commander that was driving the vehicle ended up getting a nick to the head, and you probably saw his picture in Newsweek. It was a guy that was sitting pretty much on the curb with a T-shirt on his head, bleeding. But President Karzai's life was saved that day, and everything happened so fast that it will make your head spin, you know. But we were able to protect, and if we would have failed that particular day, the war would have taken a turn for the worse because the special operators could not even protect the president of the country. Lesson learned there: take care of the boss, and the boss will take care of you. And why did we need to alter? Why did we need to be the great why of special operations of the military, or just pretty much evolve as we know it? It's because of the way they fight. They know their ground. They know what to do. They know how to do it, and they know what hurts, and they know when to have patience and hide. This is a pretty lethal enemy, so low tech, yet high effective. They know what they do, and this is how they fight. These are some shots from Roberts Ridge. This is one of the bunkers that we couldn't neutralize because we couldn't see it. Imagine snow covering all of this and then being able to just pretty much shoot in between trees and having two primary features right there protecting them from our incoming fire. Look at the trenches. Remember I told you about that uphill battle? This is probably what we would have encountered if we would have let those guys go a little bit farther. They would have dug in, gotten those RPGs, and pretty much made us freaking gone. That is how they fight. And this is one of the guns that ended up killing Chappie and Neil, possibly. And, man, they just know. Look at the structure. You know, shooting downhill, they can move that tripod up anywhere where they need to go, and you cannot pretty much penetrate that. You know, you saw some of that in Normandy, how pretty much everybody was on high ground, well barricaded, shooting down, and you had to take significant casualties to be able to neutralize the threat. But we bring some good firepower, and that's why the Air Force is great, air power, as witness here. These are a couple of 500-pound bombs, and this is a shot of Tora Bora. I have a friend, combat controller Joe O'Keefe, that is still waiting on his check because this was when Bin Laden was hiding in Tora Bora. And he spent so much ammunition out there for 72 hours straight that he swears to kill Bin Laden. And he says that is a stunt double. So he's still waiting for the check. When he retired, the retirement cake was a big check for the money he never got. But that is pretty amazing all on its own. And these are pictures following Roberts Ridge. Operation Anaconda did not end that day. There were a lot of people that ended up leaving the area that survived the attack, especially the airstrikes following the intense firefight. A lot of them were Chechens, and a lot of them were pretty much Afghan locals, facilitating for these foreign fighters to be able to go ahead and do what they did. Found a lot of things. When we found the bodies, we knew that there was equipment missing. We found some horrific things done to our friends, which pretty much made us angrier. So we wanted to go ahead and get more payback once again. The intelligence kept rolling, and we had just gotten in country, and that we had the call for this one particular mission. And that mission was to intercept some vehicles heading towards a training site that potentially has some of the survivors of Anaconda. What you're looking at here is after killing all the enemy, this is John Chapman's helmet and John Chapman's weapon by serial number. They had it. In addition, this is his MVG catcher's mask right there. Also, this is Neil Roberts' sniper rifle and his fire department watch cap. See, Neil had written September 11, 2001 in the buttstock of his rifle. So they ended up getting that from him. And also his LBE and some of the other equipment that he was carrying. Not only that, but this bastard right here had the nerve to, after Neil was shot and killed and pretty much all the atrocities were done to him, he stole Neil's jacket. That is a Mountain Hardware Chugach jacket. And it had Neil's initials on it. So not only did we take the jacket back, we ended up dropping a couple more bombs to make that place just totally disappear. Out of anger and out of payback, because our boys back needed some good news. There's no place like home. Part of that is because of the environment that we're put in and the time that we spend away from home. We end up spending on the average between 200 and 300 days out of the year away from our loved ones. And this is pretty much the environment that we live in. Pretty much looks like a refugee camp. This is kind of like Tony Montana in freaking Freedom Town in Scarface right there. But you're talking dust. You're talking insects. You're talking, you know, bad nutrition. Worse weather. It gets too cold. It gets too warm. You have to go to 10,000 feet. You have to work in the valley with mosquitoes. You have malaria. You have to take all these pills to go along with it. It takes a toll on the body. Going back to the physical fitness aspect of things, that's one of the other key reasons. We don't do it just to remain fit. We do it because we have to, because of nature, the things that we have to survive, the things that we have to endure. And it is Afghanistan is probably one of the toughest terrain that I have ever worked on, just because it can go from jungle to desert, desert to high mountaineering scenarios. And we do all these things because we know that somebody's got to do this job, because if we don't do it, the possibility of somebody else striking our country, our own soil, is there. And that's when we fight the war within. It's pretty much, we go through a lot. I recently found out that there's an article in Men's Journal, which I have the article right in there, What the War Did to Andy is called, the article. Andy Kubik is a good friend of mine, combat controller, Silver Star recipient in Afghanistan, and Bronze Star with Valor in Bosnia. Andy got put in a lot of bad situations, and Andy did so honorably and fought valiantly and ended up coming up on top until he returned home. When he got home, he got extremely paranoid, started hitting the bottles, started hitting pills, and was basically let go of the service. So he goes to Michigan, and then he starts committing crimes just because he needs that adrenaline. He needs to do something that puts him in danger. And long story short, Andy is now in a VA hospital going to some treatment for substance abuse and PTSD. But how does a warrior go from top performer to that? How do we deal when our friends die in helicopter crashes? How do we feel when I get to come home and kiss Janet and my friend is dead in Afghanistan and I have the widow standing there weeping next to us? How do we deal looking at the locker next to you in the team room and knowing that Scott Sather is never going to come back? How do you deal with the people that you couldn't save when I couldn't save a life, and that's what I'm designed to do? That's what you pay me to do, to bring people back home, and I couldn't save it. How could I deal with the people I have killed, the people that I have put bullets into, those who weren't there and those that you have questions about? That is exactly the struggle. And I'll tell you that it's not easy. And demons will catch up with all of us at some point. They got a hold of Andy, and Andy didn't have a family support. His wife left him, and his kid pretty much went with the wife. But the one thing that I personally have is sitting right here in the front row, and that is the support that I have gotten from Janet and my family. Janet herself has to put up with, when Ray was doing surveillance and reconnaissance missions, sleeping in a half sleeping bag up to here with a big puffy jacket in snow, just getting about 2 hours of sleep at a time just to make sure nobody walked up on us and pretty much surprised us, because it would be pretty embarrassing to be found dead in CNN with a half sleeping bag that looks like a sack raise. And then it's like, what the hell is the special operations guy doing up there getting shot after a sack raise? But we ended up doing a lot of different things, and I will come home and we had this nice king Tempur-Pedic bed. And I'll come home all smelly because we were eating the food. I had the long beer. There was probably chainsaw chicken stuck in it still. And she will be like, all right, you need to shower. You need to go ahead and shave that thing and, you know, come to bed. So as I'm sleeping, well, this is after, you know, but as I'm sleeping, she has this bed three quarters to herself, and I'm still sleeping like a mummy. Not only that, but any minor noise, I will stand up, pop up like a jack in a box. She could deal with that. The one thing that got her was the one eyeball open. That was freaking her out. So she's like, you know what? That eye thing, you got to stop it, all right? Otherwise, you're going to the couch. So we ended up doing that. My point is that sense of humor has carried me through a lot of this, and it continues to do because very few things in life I take serious. Combat is one of them. You have seen the face, and then you have seen the face. There's two different guys, and Janet calls it the switch. When I'm in combat, I turn into a totally different person. When I come home, I have to flick that switch, not only because of my combat mentality, but also because she's been running the house. And if I try to change anything that she's done, I'm telling you, the Taliban's got nothing on my baby. She scares me. But this particular guy right here, that is my helmet. This is his helmet. And if you look at mine, it looks like a Kevlar yarmulke on top of his head because this guy is probably about like 6'5", about 260 pounds, and then there's little old me. And we had to special order his helmet because the Air Force didn't have his size. That's how big this animal's head is. And so I was just like, I put it on, and it's kind of like I looked like one of those Mary Brothers characters in there, but or Spaceballs for that matter. And then the last thing that I want to talk about on this slide is about our buddies that make it back, but they're not the same anymore. Chad Giske. Jack here recently got injured in a parachuting accident to where he's a quadriplegic right now. Low visibility, no markings on the landing zone, pretty much came in too hard with all his equipment on, 100 pounds plus of equipment, broke his neck upon landing. So now we're following his recovery right now, but these are good friends that they don't get to be coming to us like they were before. But one thing that doesn't change is that they're still our family. Their families are our families, and we really embrace every single one of them. Jack will never be out of our scope. He's moving to Dallas here on April 6th, and I'm pretty sure that guys are going to be riding their Harleys up there because he's a big Harley rider, to go and visit him every so often, just like we do with Chad Giske. And not only us, but the wives partake on this. There is no wife out there that has lost her husband or lost some capacity of her husband that doesn't have 20 more wanting to take care of her and make sure she's got everything she needs. That is the true essence of Special Operations family. Just like the Spartans, remember I talked about them earlier. It was a tight community to where a man can look at his woman and she can pretty much put a sword to somebody's gut if she felt that they were disrespecting the family. And she's probably got about three swords and a gun in her purse or something. And then there's those who wait for us. And I talked a lot about Janet because, I mean, she is my saving grace. She listens. She's pretty much there for me all the time. And never once has she complained. The only time that I have come home from combat is when her mom, Sally, was about to pass away. And that was the time that she said, Ray, it's time. And those were good enough words to where I found my way home and I was able to be there for Sally, for Janet and Bill, before she passed on. Outside of that, she's fully supportive. She's always there, and she's always just wanting to see which one of our guys is pretty much going to be the one coming home victorious and which one is going to tell the best stories. My family right here, Mom and Dad, this is the woman that put up with the on the roof kid. This is the man that pretty much told her to whack me because he wouldn't whack me when I was a kid. He delegated the ass whoopings to Mom. Isn't that great? Talk about psyops. That is the good one. Mom is the one that pretty much hands it over. Until what time I had a rubber band with a lollipop stick and Dad had told me to go. He didn't want me watching TV with him, Rat Patrol, what have you. And I had a clear view of him. This is the beginning of my sniper training. And I'm like, man, you didn't watch me. The thing misfired. And I hit him right in the back of the ear. I didn't come out of the room for about 24 hours. Yeah. So... But this is something to look forward to. This is what keeps us going day by day. And the biggest lesson learned here is that it wasn't anger. That's not why I wanted to fight. Because a true warrior fights not because he hates what's in front of him, but because he lost what's left behind. Not only them sitting right there in the front row, but all of you, the people that support us day in and day out. And then there's those who can never come back. John Chapman, Scott Sather, Scott Duffman, Adam Brown recently SEAL killed last week. Neil Roberts, Jason Cunningham, Dusty Markham. Those are all close friends that have passed on. Have died at the end of the hands of the enemy. But they wouldn't have it any other way. Spartans always talked about dying a beautiful death. We fight, to die an honorable death. If I'm going to go, I want to go doing what I do best, as I'm pretty sure all these men have pretty much thought about before they went out. A lot of us write letters that come out once we're gone to explain the reason of why we're content with what we did. Because we accept it every day. Every day we set foot, when we put on our trousers and we go to work, it may be our last, whether it's training, whether it's combat. Anything can happen. But we accept that because that's what we signed up to do. That's what's special about special operations. It's coming to terms with what you're willing to do and how much you're willing to sacrifice. And I know that my wife is willing to sacrifice it all with me. She won't like it when I'm gone, but she knows I died doing what I love to do. Before I go ahead and say some closing words here, I want to say that I love every single one of these men like if they were my brothers. And even though they cannot be here with us, they are. Because every time we step into the fight now, they're not fighting just Ray Colon Lopez. They're fighting all seven of those guys that I mentioned with me, within me, because we carry them with us. Their memory lives, and we have memorials. We have streets named after them. We have museum exhibits for them. And we just never, ever, ever let go, because that is also something that fuels the fire within, dealing with those demons that I spoke about. It's everything that's been sacrificed so far for you not to be able to succeed in this particular mission. And that is the essence of Special Operations Warrior.